Rinpoche is saying, whenever Rinpoche enters the room, please don't always get up. And also when he leaves the room, don't get up. But you should stay meditating. So there is no need to get up, no need to prostrate. Just stay meditating. Then it says, that non-conceptuality that's luminous and clear is the arising of the shamatha experience. So now there is a clear awareness that knows whether or not thoughts arise. And that's actually the beginning of vipassana, or it is a true seeing, especially insight. It is when there is no thought in the mind and you know that state. You know that it all is your own mind. And that nature of mind is like space. So that is what you realize through practice. So this term non-conceptuality, what that means is non-conceptuality actually does not mean no concept. It doesn't mean that there is no thought. But it means that even if there is a thought, you do not become involved in that thought. You don't analyze that thought. You don't grasp at the thought. You just let the thought be. And if you just let it be, it will dissipate like a wave on water. But if you grasp at it, grasping also means that you want to reject it. You think that I don't want to have a thought. I want to have no thought. If you think in this way, then actually that feeling of thought becomes even stronger. And then almost it becomes like the thought is an actual thing. And that then causes you to accumulate karma and form habitual imprints. So instead, when anger, for example, arises, you recognize it, you just let it be, and it slowly dissolves on its own like a wave on water without you having to engage in it in any way. For example, if you look at all these people here in the room, there's a lot of people, then you wouldn't analyze them thinking that, oh, this person is from this country, that person is from that country. So you wouldn't be very tense and tight and nervous around people. You would just think nothing, really. And then if you close your eyes and meditate, it's almost like there's nobody here. So there is no thought of there is someone or there is no one. You just rest within the state of non-conceptuality. And so that is why those realized ones who know that, meditators, are fearless. They are not anxious or nervous in the face of other people. So they can just walk up to someone and tell them anything. They would not feel nervous about that because they don't analyze, they don't think about it. They just remain within this luminous state of the mind. On the basis of that meditative experience, this basis here, so this is the foundation of shamatha. So once you have attained shamatha, what do you do with shamatha? Then you need to gain insight. You need to attain vipassana, and that is the clarity of mind that knows what thoughts arise or not arise. It is the clear awareness. And what is the essence of that awareness? During the empowerment, we have learned it is clear, empty awareness. And just rest within that state evenly. Clarity means that you clearly know whether or not thoughts arise. Emptiness means that whatever thought arises, you let it be, and you experience how it naturally dissolves like a wave on water. And then when you have habituated to that meditative state for a very long time, sometimes there is just no thought whatsoever, no thought at all. And then very pleasant experiences may arise, meditative experiences. At that point, you should not think that this is so wonderful. I always want to have that. Don't think that, because that develops into attachment. And also, do not try to reject negative experiences. Do not think that this was not good. I must not have this again. Just feel that anything may arise. Let anything arise. You're just like a train. I'm cutting through a mountain, going straight. No matter what arises, you keep going. Whatever coarse and subtle thoughts or experiences arise, you just, no matter what it is, you don't hold on to it. You don't think even about it. You just continue your meditation. So that is the at the basis of that meditative experience. While supplicating the precious jewels, the three jewels, so it is also important to have faith and a pure perception. And that also means that you understand the qualities of the three jewels. So you supplicate the three jewels. So often we just call for them. We call the jewels, the Buddha and the Dharma and so on. But what does that actually mean? It's not just actually something that like Buddhists do now, but actually now what is the Buddha really? We need to understand the quality of a Buddha. And so why is the Buddha so important? It's because if there is no Buddha, there is no Dharma. If there is no Dharma, there is no liberation. Because we grasp at the self, and due to that, we develop afflictive emotions. And these six afflictions will continuously cause us to wander in the six realms of samsara. Let's think about the suffering of the three lower realms. When we think about the four thoughts that turn the mind, we reflect on the suffering of all beings, humans and animals and so forth. Reflecting on the four thoughts is a method to cultivate bodhicitta where it has not yet arisen. So through that we understand the suffering of the three lower realms, and we understand the qualities of a precious human body. And where does this knowledge come from? It comes from the three jewels, because the three jewels showed us the path. For example, when we take the refuge vow, we learn that first there is the Buddha, and the Buddha taught the Dharma. And what is the Dharma? It is to understand karma, cause and effect. So you want to be happy, but you don't know the cause of happiness. So you think that I have to work hard, I have to be really diligent, but that's not the cause of happiness. No matter how hard you try, how hard you work, often you still don't find happiness. Some find happiness, some don't. And that's because of karma. But people don't know that it is because of karma. People don't know that the cause of their happiness is actually love and compassion. So this is the path that is shown to us by the three jewels. So that's the kindness of the Buddha who showed us the path, which is the Dharma. So the Buddha taught them the Dharma, and from the Dharma then appeared the Sangha. And so the Dharma consists of 84,000 different Dharma teachings. And there is the form of them, the Buddha, like a statue, for example. Or there is the many volumes of scriptures of Gangyur and Dengyur, the Buddha's teachings. Even though all of that exists, if we would not have a Sangha, then we would have no one who explains that, all of that to us. So then just the mere existence of all these books really is of no benefit to us personally. In order to understand all of the Buddha's teachings, we need someone who understands them and explains it to us. And actually that is why I personally feel that the Sangha is really most precious, even actually more precious than the Buddha and the Dharma, because the Sangha is the one who kind of translates it all to us, explains it all to us. And the Sangha anyways is an embodiment of the three jewels. The Sangha's body is the Sangha, the speech is the Dharma, and the mind is the Buddha. So the mind is the Buddha, and that mind is our own mind. It is a single mental continuum. And we call the Sangha also Noble Sangha. That is because we as ordinary people, we do have love, for example, for our companions, but our love is very limited, and we quickly lose it when something happens, a condition. Then that person we love becomes our worst enemy. It's impermanent. However, the love of a Sangha is for all sentient beings. And this is what makes them noble, supreme. Their love is great. Even if someone harms them, they will be patient. An ordinary person, if you hurt them, their love becomes anger. If you hurt a Sangha, they practice patience because they know that the benefit of self and others is love and nothing else. So by all means, that is what they hold on to. They know that this is the only cause of temporary happiness in the higher realms and the cause of ultimate enlightenment. So this is what the Buddha had given to us. It is love and compassion. This is what the Sangha has understood. And that is what the Sangha shares with us. So even if someone were to come and threaten to kill a Sangha, they would not get angry. They would sustain their love, thinking that I'm a Sangha. I must have love for all. I must have patience. This is what makes them noble. That is why me, for example, I'm a Sangha. That is why I'm sitting on a higher chair. Actually, it's not because I have any great quality or learning, but I understand the power of love and patience. And that is what a Sangha needs. If you're a Sangha, you should think that I need to have that. I need to have love. And that love needs to be pure. And I need to have patience when someone harms me. So that is a Sangha, most precious among the three jewels. And now, who is actually a Sangha? Actually, it's anyone who has a religion at all. All the religions in the world have good qualities. It is just often the problem is that people mix it with politics and manipulation to cause disturbances and conflict. But it's not the fault of the religion, actually. It's the fault of the person. And it even happens within Buddhism, actually. But the religion itself, actually, all the religions want to benefit sentient beings. They all talk about generosity and patience and non-violence and so forth. So actually, all religions are really very good. And all religious practitioners in the world are Sangha. And all sentient beings who do not have a religion are parents. If you only think in this way, your mind will become very vast. So then you will develop a sense of faith and pure perception towards higher beings, and then love and compassion for sentient beings. And in that way, if you supplicate to the three jewels, you understand their true meaning, and that is the inner three jewels. The Buddha is actually within you. Your inner Buddha is your mindfulness. And that mindfulness, what does it have to do? It has to be mindful of love and compassion. So the Buddha sustains the Dharma, or mindfulness sustains love and compassion. So even though we have the outer three jewels of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, if we do not develop the inner three jewels of wisdom and compassion, then the outer three jewels on their own cannot protect us. What actually protects you is the inner three jewels within your own mind. And among those, what really protects you is your own love and compassion. That's your true refuge. So then it says, gain certainty by studying and contemplating the Dharma. So when we study the Dharma, what do we mainly have to learn about? It is that, first of all, there is past and future lives, and there is karma. Mainly, we really have to understand karma. So if we think about that, about karma, we speak about happiness and the cause of happiness. The only cause of happiness is love. The only cause of suffering is self-grasping. In order to eliminate self-grasping, the only way to do that is cultivating love. You mentioned that before. That's the only cause of happiness. There is one saying that especially the older Tibetan people often say, that's really actually a great saying as a proverb. So they say, if I'm happy, then that's the kindness of the three jewels. And if things go wrong, that's my karma. So that's actually a very excellent view on things. And that is a very good habit that the Tibetan people have, actually. And actually, in this country, I also noticed that people have a good habit of respecting the elder, which is actually excellent. That's what we have to do. We have to give them love and respect. And so, in any case, love and compassion and a pure perception. If we develop that, what becomes pure when you develop a pure perception? First, you become pure or free of pride. And so we speak about two systems, the mundane and the spiritual systems. And when we follow a spiritual path, the root of that path is that the path is a path to benefit and happiness on a temporary and ultimate sense. We are introduced to the qualities of bodhicitta. And in the worldly mundane path, that is the path of external development, scientific, technological developments, and so on, which also actually brings some happiness and well-being to the people. But then it doesn't actually bring them ultimate happiness. So people still experience suffering. So on the one hand, we have it all very good because we have found the precious human body. And actually, that is because we have practiced ethical conduct in a previous life. Or if you have a lot of wealth, then that's because you have practiced generosity. Or if you have harmonious relationships and beautiful face and long life and so on, that's a quality of patience. So those practices of generosity, morality, and patience lead to birth in the higher realms as gods and humans. And there is no other cause for such a birth. And those three practices actually have their root in love. Because we love, we practice generosity, we practice morality, we practice patience. And of course, with all of these practices, we need to practice diligence. And then we practice meditation and wisdom, and thereby we attain ultimate enlightenment. Enlightenment in Tibetan means sangye, and sang means to clear away. And so what is cleared away is all selfish notions, all self-grasping. And when that is cleared away, you realize the non-duality of self and other. So the mind becomes vast, which is the second syllable, gye, expansive or vast. The ultimate result, the mind becomes just like space. And all of that ultimately actually comes from love. So it's the cause of all temporary happiness of birth in the higher realms and the cause of ultimate enlightenment. When you love others, you practice the six paramitas, and the result of the six paramitas is birth in the higher realms and ultimately enlightenment. So this is what the Dharma actually teaches us. Even though you receive 100 Dharma teachings, that is the essence of all of them. So if you have that, it's inconceivable. If you do not have that, you will never be able to lift yourself out of samsara, of the three lower realms, because you keep clinging at a self. Then regarding the worldly system, there's worldly teachers, for example, who also teach us things about this life, how we improve things in this external world. But they cannot really teach us mental peace and happiness. Only the religions can do that. No matter how much money you may accumulate, actually, often the more money we accumulate, the worse it gets, the more we suffer, and often in the end, people commit suicide. So it's important to practice the union of two systems, the worldly and the spiritual, as a means to achieve temporary and ultimate happiness. And it's important to consider the teachers of both systems as extremely precious. When you think in this way, your mind becomes vast. So this is how I myself practice. This is how I increase my own love. Because if I just think in an abstract sense of all mother sentient beings, it doesn't really generate a real feeling. So a real feeling must arise, and an actual feeling arises when you remember the kindness of your parents, your teachers, and your country. For example, your country. If you wouldn't have your country, you wouldn't have roads and electricity and water and so on. So that when you recognize that, you feel a sense of gratitude for your country, and then you want everyone in this country to be happy. Then you want all sentient beings to be happy. So that is the aspiration of love and a pure perception. So in this way, when you cultivate, when you remember the three jewels with kindness, what you recollect is the actual root of happiness, because this is the kindness that the three jewels have given to you. They gave you love, but you must not allow it to become spoiled, but regard it as very precious. So even at the cost of your life, then you would not give up your love. There's this prayer where we say, I supplicate to Bodhicitta, which is the ultimate guru. So your inner Buddha is your own wisdom, your awareness. Your inner Dharma is love. These are the inner jewels. And that's most important. No matter how much you study and reflect and meditate, that is the ultimate point. If you do not attain that, no matter how much you study, you have missed the point. So what you ultimately need to, the ultimate fruition that has to arise is bodhicitta. And if it doesn't arise, then all the talking about Dharma and the knowledge about it is really useless. So we speak about the Dharma, but then often our lip service towards the Dharma creates a lot of conflict too. So we have to be clear about what is the ultimate actual thing that we need to attain. And that is love. That is what we need to understand. So if you understand that, when love arises, only then wisdom arises. When there is no love, then also no wisdom arises. So decide upon that just one, that one thing, which is the precious bodhicitta. So this point about now studying and contemplating the Dharma is actually very meaningful. It's very important to us. There's something important for us to understand. So there is those teachers, the scholars who uphold the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings of the scriptures. Mainly in the old days, especially, these were the teachers of the Gelugpa and the Sakya lineages. They mainly focused on upholding the scriptural tradition of the Buddha's teachings. And they would undergo many years and decades of Dharma study, and they would have debates and discussions and so on. And then the Nyingma and Kagyu lineages mainly focus on practice. So nowadays, however, it's not so straightforward. Actually, nowadays also the Nyingma and the Kagyu lineages focus a lot about the scriptures and debate, and also the others are engaging in practice. But so what we need to understand here is that it is very difficult if one thinks that if I just study all the scriptures really well, then I will perfect and master the path. So that is very, that would be very difficult. So on the one hand, we have those scholars who are upholding the lineages, and that is necessary for them. They need to debate, they need to engage in all these activities in order to uphold the lineage. And they debate with each other, for example, only in order to refine each other's understanding of the Dharma. And that's necessary too, because the Buddha had himself said, you should analyze, examine my teachings just like you would examine gold. So you would cut it and rub it and polish it until it reveals itself. So we have to analyze the teachings and we have to ask questions. It's good to ask questions. And then those scholars debate, which is necessary for them. But then we as practitioners, if we take those words of debate and bring them into our practice, then we make a mistake. It is said that the great scholars need to debate and uphold the lineage, but simple-minded people like ourselves must not have a biased view. So us practitioners are the simple-minded ones, and so the thing that we need to understand is, no matter what lineage of the four lineages you follow, the essence is bodhicitta, to understand the twofold truth. There is this quote by the Buddha in the Samadhi Raja Sutra. And so basically the Buddha taught the teachings extensively. So we mentioned before there are the teachings on, which are the antidote to desire, the teachings on the Vinaya teachings, for example. There is the 24,000 volumes. And then there is the antidote to ignorance, the Abhidharma, also 24,000. And the antidote to anger, the Sutra, Pitaka, also 24,000. So there's these endless teachings anyways. And so regarding that, there is a quote that I came across when I was a young boy. And actually, I don't have a lot of learning, but when I saw that, something really clicked in my mind. I understood something. That actually, what I decided upon after reading that quote is that it's enough if I just hold on to love. So the quote goes like that. So in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, the Buddha said, I have taught them the Dharma, the sutras in thousands of world systems, and while my words are diverse, their meaning is a single one. And if you practice this single meaning, it is like practicing all my words. So what is the single meaning? It is the precious bodhicitta. First, it is the relative bodhicitta, which is love and compassion. When that arises, actually ultimate bodhicitta naturally arises. And ultimate bodhicitta is to realize the absence of a self. So that is how we as practitioners should approach it. All we need to do as practitioners is to hold on to bodhicitta. Because when we focus too much on what the scholars do when they debate, then we fixate on those words that they say and these arguments that they pose, and then we say, oh, they said this and they said that, then we become all caught up in these arguments. So actually, these lineages are like boxes that need to be like a vessel that need to be sustained. So if they do not debate, then they will decline. So they need to do that in order to uphold the lineage. But for us practitioners, we should not bring those arguments of the debate into our practice, but rather focus on the practice of cultivating the precious bodhicitta. So this is actually a very very significant instruction. And this is how we need to understand this crucial point here of studying and contemplating the Dharma with certainty. So to gain this certainty, a person who has gained this certainty, for example, is someone like Lord Jigden Sumgen, as he mentioned yesterday, the Fivefold Path of Mahamudra, also called the Five Essences. So no matter what lineage you follow, whatever Buddhist tradition, it all has the same essence. So we have three levels of the path of individual liberation, the Bodhisattvas and the Vajrayana. Whatever you practice, it has a single essence included in those five essences. So, Dharma friends, this is how you should reflect on that in terms of studying and reflecting on the Dharma. How are those five essences essences? That's important to understand. Now, if you understand that, it doesn't actually matter anymore which lineage you follow, what deity you practice, and so on. Any lineage, any lama, when they give a teaching or when they confer an empowerment, it always begins with refuge and cultivating bodhicitta. For example, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, when he gives the great Kala Chakra empowerment, also begins with refuge and bodhicitta. And when I, for example, give this small empowerment, also begins with refuge and the motivation of bodhicitta, like yesterday in the Fivefold Path. So especially for sentient beings living in the degenerate age who are faithful and who want to practice, these five essences are very significant. They are the essence of all Dharma. The essence of the Dharma is bodhicitta, which is the first essence. All Buddhist traditions speak about precious bodhicitta. Second, the essence of the Vajrayana is the Yidam deity. So even though you receive hundreds of empowerments, you practice hundreds of deities, what is the ultimate essence? Any deity that you practice, when you visualize the form of that deity, that purifies the karmic imprints of the body, the inner body and outer form. Then when you recite the deity's mantra, that purifies the karmic imprints of the ordinary speech and the outer sound and the grasping at the reality, the truth of one's own speech. So one realizes sound emptiness, the empty nature of sound. And then by cultivating a mind of bodhicitta, we purify the karmic imprints of the mind, which is self-grasping. And only bodhicitta can do that. So if you practice the Vajrayana, but you do not purify self-grasping in your mind, you cannot actually practice a deity. So in a sadhana context, we first purify all the emptiness with the Svabhava Shuddhang mantra. And then from there, first we cultivate a wish to benefit sentient beings. And that is the foundation for deity practice. On the basis of altruism, you then visualize yourself as the deity. Guru Rinpoche actually had said, what we call the deity is nothing else but bodhicitta. If you don't understand that, then you might visualize yourself as the deity and say, I am the deity, you look like the deity, but there still is suffering and there still is self-grasping. So this kind of deity practice that is based on self-grasping leads to birth as an evil spirit, like a demonic birth. So if the basis of deity yoga is bodhicitta, the actual deity arises, which is a manifestation of bodhicitta. That's the Sambhogakaya and the Nirmanakaya. So that is why Jigden Sumgen said, the essence of the Dharma is bodhicitta, the essence of the Yidam, of Vajrayana is the Yidam, Then third, the essence of all blessings is guru devotion. Fourth, the essence of the ultimate truth is Mahamudra. And actually, there is nothing which is not included in Mahamudra. For example, those who follow the path of logic and reasoning, they study the Madhyamaka, the great middle way. Or there are those who follow the practice blessing lineage of Mahamudra or Dzogchen. But then, now in the lineage, as it says, for example, Dzogchen is very precious. It's most precious. And the scholars say that in order to refine each other's understanding of the Dharma, in order to uphold the lineage. But actually, there's no duality. Within primordial wisdom, there cannot be a duality. If there is a duality, there is something wrong. So we cannot say that there is one wisdom of Dzogchen and one wisdom of Mahamudra. There is something wrong when we say that. Because it is said that within the expanse of primordial wisdom, all the Buddhas are one. So non-duality is what we call primordial wisdom. So the ultimate truth, the essence of the ultimate truth is Mahamudra. And fifth, the essence of method is dedication. So now through Buddhist practices, we cultivate love and we say that we benefit sentient beings. So how do we really benefit sentient beings? It is actually through dedication, through aspiration. Dedication actually means just you give love to somebody else. That is dedication. You pass on your love. And what's the love of the Buddhas? It is vast like space for all mother sentient beings, which is unlike our love that we have for our companions. But even if that love is pure, for example, we can stay with one another for our entire life. Or even if you love your cat or your dog, they will naturally follow you around wherever you go. That's the power of love. So the love of all the Buddhas is even greater than that. It is for all sentient beings. And sentient beings are limitless as space. And for as long as sentient beings exist, the Buddha's enlightened activities will exist. Such is the love of the Buddha. That is the quality of the three jewels. And through that love, they can liberate sentient beings from samsara. Ultimately, by introducing them, saying there is no actual samsara, you are just like an ice block. It is only temporary. There is no real, actually existing sentient being. If you just eliminate self-grasping, you are Buddha. This temporary stain. When that is removed, you are a Buddha. So the Buddhas have no bias, actually. The Buddhas have no thought of this is Sakya, this is Gelugpa, this is a Christian, this is a Muslim, and so on. There is no separation within their minds. And there is no ultimate separation because everyone has a mind, and whoever has a mind has the cause of Buddhahood, actually. So that is the enlightened mind of the Buddha, the intent of the Buddha. And so that is those five essences. And when the essence of method is dedication. So when we dedicate the roots of virtue accumulated in the three times, which actually is a moment of love arising within you, itself naturally becomes dedication. And so we're dedicating all these roots of virtue of body, speech, and mind. And as the Buddhas have done, so how the Buddhas have done it after three times is just by cultivating love. This is how the Buddhas of the past have done it, how they will always do it in the future, and how they're doing it now. So that is that root of virtue of samsara and nirvana and of the three times that we mention when we dedicate. So once you have recognized that, once you have gained certainty in that, then you can say things like that. And once you have gained certainty, then actually you can practice any lineage. You can engage in any meditation practice. You can practice any deity. So you can have this kind of confidence of saying things like that once you have gained such certainty. So take the vipassana that brings the understanding of no self. So that due to that self, there we have this perception of being a solid entity, an individual. And so then when you recognize by looking at the nature of the mind, when you look at the mind, you recognize there is actually no such a self that you will ever find. So as you keep looking at the mind, the experience of it being like space increases. There is this quote in the Heart Sutra regarding the understanding or the wisdom, it's called the individually discriminating wisdom. And so in the Heart Sutra it says, this wisdom is the sphere of activity or the dimension of self-knowing awareness. Chikten Sumgen also said in the Gong Chik that whatever is done in this world is done by the Buddhas. The Buddhas, anything that is done by Buddhas. So what that means is that one's own awareness is actually in essence the Buddha. And everything that is done in this world is done by awareness, by consciousness. That is why everything that is done by the Buddha. Everything is done by consciousness. So now there is the consciousness of sentient beings and Buddhas, but it's still the same mind. That's related to a quote in the Samantabhadra prayer where it says, if you recognize it, you are a Buddha. Not recognizing it, you are a sentient being wandering in samsara. So this self-knowing awareness, when you see it, that is the Buddha. What you see is the Buddha. And when you see it, all dualistic thought of self and other collapse. There is a perception maybe of a duality of bodies, but you know that there is no duality within the mind. So when you realize that, you have realized vipassana. You have seen the true nature of the mind. It is clear awareness. And this awareness cannot be said to be something existing because it is empty like space. Nor can it be said to be something non-existing because there is a clear awareness. So this is what is meant with this union of clarity and emptiness. And if you always remain within that state, you are always happy. There is no suffering at all. This state is a state of great bliss that is free of all suffering. Space doesn't suffer. So that's the ultimate truth. And also there is one verse in the 37 practices that explains the ultimate truth. Actually, personally, this verse has benefited me the most to understand the ultimate truth. So it's verse number 22, where it says, appearances are one's own mind. From the beginning, mind's nature is free from the extremes of elaboration. Knowing this, not to engage the mind in subject-object duality is the bodhisattva's practice. So we need to realize that appearances are one's own mind, and that mind itself is emptiness. So actually there is no separation. There is no outer external object and inner mind. They are all one. So therefore we cannot speak of the mind as being out there or inside. It's everywhere. There is no outer and no inner. So realizing that clearly is this individually discriminating wisdom, clearly knowing wisdom, that everything is the mind. Everything is created by the mind. The mind created a person, and the person created the world. How do people create the world? This world, the universe, is created by the collective karma and imprints. For example, we have this collective perception of this is our country. We all perceive it that way. So how we can understand that is also based on our dreams. When you're dreaming, the body lies there in your bed, doing nothing really. But in your mind, you are creating a whole little universe on its own for some time, where you do all kinds of things. You engage in all kinds of activities. All kinds of appearances manifest. It's the reflection of your own mind. Only you see it. Nobody else. So appearances are one's own mind. When you realize that, the nature of your mind in this way, that is what we call realizing the mind that is free from the four extremes of existence and non-existence. So that is what we are introduced to also during the empowerment, when we are shown the crystal ball as an example. Everything is your mind. For example, when the sun shines on the crystal, rainbow lights emerge from it. An ordinary person might think that when they see the rainbows, they might think that the rainbows are separate and that they forget about the crystal. But actually, the rainbows are part of the crystal. They are a radiance of the crystal. Or, for example, a tree and its branches. The branches are part of the tree. They're not separate. And so similarly, everything that appears is the perception of your own mind. The outer universe is a creation of the collective karmas and imprints, and the inner sentient beings is a creation of one's individual personal karmas and imprints. Everything is a reflection of your mind. For example, the hell realm is a natural reflection of your own hatred, or the hungry spirits are a natural reflection of greed, or jealousy, the god of the jealous gods, and so forth. So the six realms of samsara are a natural manifestation of the six afflictive emotions. And even though we speak about the six realms of samsara, actually we can observe the suffering of the six realms within the human world. Within the human world alone, actually, we have all of the suffering of the six realms of samsara. And then when you see that, it should remind you of the cause of all that suffering, the afflictive emotions, and the root of those afflictions being self-grasping. So now when you gain certainty here, this gaining of certainty is that now I have understood that. I have understood that appearances are one's own mind. Everything, the three lower realms, are a reflection of the mind, and also the Pure Lands. The Pure Lands are a natural reflection of bodhicitta. So this is at the gaining of certainty now that you understand when you take vipassana, that brings the understanding of no self. So what you realize here, when you realize the view of vipassana, of true seeing, is what you truly see is that samsara and nirvana have a single basis. So this vipassana, it is your clear awareness. And regarding that, it says also in the 37 practices, when you practice vipassana, vipassana is combined or founded on shamatha. And so first there is shamatha, where you rest within a thought-free state of mind. And then when thoughts arise, they disappear again. You can let them go. And why? It is because through vipassana you have realized that self and other do not exist. First you have understood that self does not exist inherently. And if you know that, you also understand that others do not exist. So it sort of stands to reason. And even though thoughts may arise then, you recognize them as delusion. You don't believe in their reality. You know that if you cling to that thought, that is the cause of suffering. You accumulate karma. For example, when you cling to the thought of anger, you might get into a fight with someone and you accumulate karma. And that becomes the temporary cause of suffering. So then when you, however, know the true nature of the afflictive emotion, what you actually know is that there is no afflictive emotion. Clear awareness recognizes there is actually no afflictive emotion. So when you realize that, you also don't believe in the true existence of this other person, the outer object. You know your own Buddha nature, and you know that the other person's Buddha nature. You know that the other person just doesn't realize that. The other person doesn't realize that there is no afflictive emotion, so that is why they fight. But actually, there's nothing there. There's nothing actually to fight about. There's actually no afflictive emotion that is actually there. So realizing this, then everything becomes like an illusory play. In the sutras, this is referred to as the illusion-like samadhi. So it is just like you would become angry at a character, an actor on TV in a movie. It would be pointless. So this is, according to how it is explained in the 37 practices, when we have habituated to vipassana, which is combined with shamatha, what you habituate to is the afflictive emotions when they arise. So we can say that it has become vipassana when you let go of those afflictions in the manner of recognizing their illusory nature.
So
So it says, and tied a sturdy rope of shamatha to that. So this sturdy rope is like a life-saving rope. So the life-saving rope of shamatha is the clear awareness. That's the life-saving rope. If you lack clear awareness, then you might experience a state of abiding, of calm abiding, and you might become controlled, or carried away by this pleasurable, blissful experience, and that constitutes a temporary fault. So we can say that clear awareness is your life force. Life force, because it's something that you need to have by all means. So Milarepa had said, first you need to resolve the view. And so that is, you need to gain confidence and trust that is free of any doubts regarding the natural state of the mind, the view. And then you need to gain experience in practice, that is to always sustain a state of clear awareness. And that needs to be brought into your day-to-day conduct. Also, the Buddha had said, what we call emptiness is actually heedfulness or conscientiousness. So emptiness is clear awareness, is heedfulness. Then in all your activities, you will be heedful, careful, very peaceful and subdued. That is heedfulness. And with heedfulness, you are mindful of anything that's going on around you. For example, you know what will disturb others, what others could possibly need, and so on. Your senses are very sharp. You have awareness about what's happening around you and how you're affecting the people around you. This is how emptiness is heedfulness. And so what do we need to be heedful of? We need to be heedful of, mindful of sustaining love. Next it says, then that strong, noble being with love and compassion. So such a person is someone who, love and compassion means that it is love that, compassion that has arisen from immeasurable love. That kind of compassion we're talking about here. And so first we have to cultivate immeasurable love. We cultivate love by remembering the kindness of others and then developing a wish to repay their kindness. For example, if someone helps you just a little bit, then you would remember that over and over again all the time. So in the 37 practices also it says the attachment to loved ones wavers like water and the hatred towards enemies burns like fire. So once you have cultivated bodhicitta, there is no more sense of enemy and friends or closeness and distance. There is, for example, when there is a friend, you have a friend that you love very much, that friend becomes your support to develop more love. So he helps you to increase your love. And if there is an enemy that triggers your anger, then he becomes like your teacher, because through that enemy, you recognize your anger. So your loving friend becomes your support to increase love. So then you remember the good things they have done for you, their kindness, and then you want to repay their kindness. And how do you do that? So you think that all beings have been my parents, and just like my present mother. And then you remember the kindness of your teachers and of your country again and again. So that when you really feel that they are so kind, they have been so kind, it is like warmth, heat is arising in your mind. And that is a sign that real love begins to arise within your mind. And when love arises, then you naturally will want to protect them from suffering. And you will not want to harm them. You will do whatever you can to help them. Or in terms of your country, you want to pay your taxes, for example. You even just paying $1, you know that it benefits everyone in the country. So then you would also be able to endure all kinds of difficulties for the sake of others. For example, you will be able to serve your parents, even if that's difficult. Or you will be able to respect your teachers and so on. So if you have love, you would feel natural compassion for anyone. For example, an animal. When you see an animal, you would think that this also has been my parent in a previous life. I want to protect that being. And even if there's nothing you can do, you have the aspiration to help them. There is love, so you keep them in your heart, and that kind of love gives rise to compassion. And this compassion benefits others, and it also benefits yourself. So this compassion arises from immeasurable love. So when immeasurable love has arisen, actually compassion arises all the time, continuously. For example, I have this disciple in Singapore. She came one time and said that, so you told me to cultivate immeasurable love, and I meditated on that. So then now I'm coming back, and you know, the feeling I have is that I even feel compassion. I feel a sense of tenderness even towards objects. So she was asking, do you think that's stupid? But actually, not at all, because that's mindfulness. That's what happens when you cultivate love. When you pick up a cup, for example, you want to place it down very gently, very slowly, so you don't break it or produce a sound. That's the essence of love, actually. And that actually is in accordance with the Vinaya teachings of the Dharma. That is the power that arises when self-grasping diminishes. So as Milarepa said, first we have to resolve the view. Then we have to practice the view through meditation. But then, most crucially, we have to bring that experience into our daily conduct, where we sustain mindfulness, being mindful of love. And being mindful of love, our conduct naturally becomes peaceful and gentle. For example, when you're closing a door, you wouldn't just slam it, but you would close it very slowly, very heedfully. You would naturally, for example, observe the laws of any country. Or when you're on an airplane, you would be very heedful so as not to make things dirty or misuse or kind of waste the products that you receive and so on. So you would be very heedful at any time because love has arisen within you. So you're very heedful in your conduct. Or when you visit a family, you'd be very careful in your conduct when you're visiting them. So that's a sign of having defeated self-grasping. So when immeasurable love arises, then there will be an ongoing state of compassion, and that compassion is unobjectified and conditional, which means it's not here for some and not for others. It's there at all times for all. And that is what happens when self-grasping has diminished. So this is this strong, noble being with love and compassion. So for now, we will stop the instructions here. And in the meantime, Dharma friends, I also encourage you to keep discussing the meaning of those teachings with each other.